Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. It is time to improve your American English skills and learn about our world at the same time. Today we have two interesting stories for you. The first one tells about a new movie that deals with a time of name-calling and fear in America. Then we will tell you about a way to ask people to give you money over the internet. You are listening to As It Is on the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Here is Katie Weaver with a story that mixes entertainment and politics.
In 1950, the United States Congress tried to end the career of Dalton Trumbo, the highest-paid screenwriter in Hollywood. Now, that story is being told in the new movie, Trumbo. In 1947, Dalton Trumbo appeared before the U.S. House Un-American Activities Committee. The committee was looking for members of the Communist Party. It suspected many film industry members belonged to the greatly feared political group. Dalton Trumbo was one of the suspects. He refused to answer the committee's questions. The committee blacklisted Trumbo. That meant no one would work with him or buy his screenplays. Actor Bryan Cranston plays Dalton Trumbo. He portrays him as a difficult and disagreeable man, but also as a beautiful speaker. In Trumbo, the title character fights the government's actions with sharp thinking and a fierce spirit. The political pressure does not intimidate him.
Are you not, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Many questions can be answered yes or no only by a moron or a slave.
Bryan Cranston says the movie's message attracted him more than Trumbo's showy character.
This man who was a prolific writer, the highest paid screenwriter in Hollywood at the time, and a member of the American Communist Party, and summoned to Washington to make a statement under oath, under the penalty of imprisonment, to withdraw his First Amendment rights and be compelled to give testimony. With a very un-American question, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
You talk like a radical, but you live like a rich guy.
It's the perfect combination. The radical may fight the purity of Jesus, but the rich guy wins with the cunning of Satan.
Trumbo's sharp humor does not win him many friends. In 1950, he is sentenced for contempt of court. He is no longer permitted to work in Hollywood and loses his wealth. But he is talented and resourceful.
I'll write you a movie.
And you don't want your name on it.
No, you don't want my name on it.
Society reporter and intense anti-communist Hedda Hopper was one of Trumbo's greatest enemies. Actor Helen Mirren plays her in the movie.
Whisper a movie you've written in secret. Maybe I've even heard of it.
Maybe you have.
As it turns out, Hopper probably had heard of it. Dalton Trumbo won 2 Academy Awards for screenplays he wrote while blacklisted. He wrote them under different names. Roman Holiday won the Oscar for Best Writing in 1954. 3 years later, Trumbo's screenplay for the movie The Brave One also received an Academy Award. Jay Roach directed Trumbo. His movie's humor and its skilled cast do more than entertain. Trumbo also provides a frightening reminder of what happens when political power is abused and civil liberties are attacked. I'm Katie Weaver.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. Could you use a little extra money to start a business, or to take a trip, or to buy something you have always wanted? Do you know that you might just be able to get people to give you this money by asking over the Internet? Mary Gottschall is here to tell you how to do it. Mary?
Crowdfunding, or soliciting people online to fund projects, is rapidly growing in popularity around the world, say experts. Here's how crowdfunding works. You pitch your project to a large group of people through an online platform. If they are interested in your project, they donate money to fund your project. You pay a fee to the crowdfunding platform for hosting your appeal. For example, a popular site called Indiegogo charges a 4% fee from the total you raise. It also charges $3 for credit card processing, plus a $25 wire fee for non-U.S. campaigns. One of the largest crowdfunding sites is Kickstarter. Kickstarter is a funding platform for creative projects. Since it launched in 2009, over $2 billion has been pledged by more than 9 million people, funding more than 90,000 creative projects, says Kickstarter's website. Many artists, designers, and filmmakers have funded their projects through the platform. Most projects raise between $1,000 and $9,999, although some have raised millions of dollars, reported Kickstarter. Crowdfunding platforms cater to different audiences. Startups seeking funding from investors can turn to AngelList, Crowdfunder, or Fundable, reported Business News Daily. Other crowdfunding sites focus on charities and nonprofit organizations. Despite its benefits, crowdfunding poses legal, regulatory, and ethical challenges, say experts. Crowdfunders who raise money incorrectly could run into problems with securities law, wrote researchers Stephen Wolfson and Matthew Leese at the University of Texas. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission regulates the sale of stocks and bonds. The SEC is charged with protecting investors from scams. The agency has proposed rules that would affect crowdsourcing sites where a company is selling stock or equity, wrote Kendall Americo, a crowdfunding attorney. Crowdfunding only refers to raising funds on the Internet. Crowdsourcing is a broader term. It means using the Internet to raise funds, solve problems, or generate innovative ideas from other people. Crowdsourcing can cause innovators to lose control of their work and not be fairly paid for it, warned experts. Crowdsourcing can be an innovative way to source and/or develop creative works, wrote researchers Wolfson and Leese at the University of Texas in a paper called Look Before You Leap: Legal Pitfalls of Crowdsourcing. Yet the creators of these works can easily lose control over crowd-developed creative works if they do not pay attention to copyright laws. Ross Dawson, author of Getting Results from Crowds, said crowdsourcing could exploit people by profiting from their ideas and not paying them. Design Contest, a website for designers, warned design professionals to avoid being scammed out of money, time, or effort on crowdsourcing sites. They urge designers to find out who gets the rights to their work and how they will be paid. Despite these perils, crowdsourcing continues to grow at a rapid pace globally. Sean Moffat is managing director of Wikibrands, At a conference in Singapore, he said that the crowdsourcing market is growing 80% every year. I'm Mary Gottschall.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
More international students are studying at U.S. colleges and universities than ever before, a new report says. The report shows that nearly a million international students are studying at U.S. universities. That's among more than 20 million students at all U.S. universities. This is the highest number of international students on record since 1954. International students added $30.8 billion to the U.S. economy over the past year. Open Doors is the name of the report. Every year, the U.S. Department of State and the Institute of International Education, or IIE, work together to release an annual report. IIE studies and supports international student exchange. The Department of State and IIE released the 2015 Open Doors report last week. Alan Goodman, Ph.D., is the president of IIE. Goodman told VOA he thinks having more international students in the U.S. is good for the future.
I think it's clear that being a global citizen matters deeply to the next generation of students and our future leaders. We're hoping here at the Institute that international increasingly becomes a part of everybody's education because it's the only way we can really learn about the world we share.
The number of international students in the U.S. has increased since 2006. It increased 10% between 2014 and 2015. That was the highest increase in 35 years. China sent more students to study in the U.S. in 2015 than any other country, the report states, 304,040. That is an increase of 10.8% from last year. India sent more students to the U.S. than it had in its past. It sent the second largest number of students to the U.S. with 132,888. 100,000 strong in the Americas is a combined effort of the U.S. Department of State and several education and development organizations. The program helps make international study between Latin America and the U.S. easier and more affordable. Brazil sent 23,675 students to the U.S. That is 79% more than in 2014. The Brazil Scientific Mobility Program helped pay for the students. This program pays for science and mathematics students to study at U.S. universities for 1 year. Government scholarships were also important for students from the Middle East. Saudi Arabia had the fourth highest number of students in the U.S., with 59,945. That is an increase from last year of 11.2%. Kuwait increased its number of students by 24%. Both countries' governments have programs that pay for some of their students to study in other countries. Foreign governments pay 7.7% of fees for their students to study in the U.S. The U.S. government is also trying to increase the number of U.S. students studying in foreign countries. The number of U.S. students studying in foreign countries increased by 5.2% to 304,467 in 2014, the Open Doors report says. I'm Pete Musto.
Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In 1864, the Union of Northern States and the Confederacy of Southern States were still fighting. The Civil War began in 1861. Each side had its own constitution. Under the Union Constitution, Americans were supposed to elect a president every 4 years. 1864 was such a year. And even though a great civil war was being fought, citizens of the North prepared to choose a leader. This week in our series, Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell the story of the election of 1864.
Abraham Lincoln was completing his first term as president. He hoped to lead the nation for another 4 years. He wanted to win the war between the states. He wanted to rebuild the Union. Lincoln's Republican Party was divided. Moderate Republicans wanted to rebuild the Union as soon as the war ended. They believed Southern states should be welcomed back with full rights. Radical Republicans disagreed strongly. They demanded severe punishment for the Southern rebels.
For many months, President Lincoln worked to build a political majority. He formed a new group called the National Union Party. It included moderate Republicans and some Democrats. Lincoln succeeded in gaining the support of state and local political leaders. It soon became clear that Lincoln would be the party's presidential candidate in the election.
Several hundred radical Republicans held their own convention in Cleveland, Ohio. They formed a new political party called the Radical Democracy. They nominated explorer John Fremont as their candidate for the national election. Fremont had been the Republican presidential candidate 8 years earlier. Most of the radical Republicans in Congress did not take part in the convention in Cleveland. They refused to support Fremont. They felt he had no chance to win the election.
President Lincoln's new National Union Party held its convention in Baltimore, Maryland. Convention delegates quickly approved a party statement. The statement supported the Union and the war. It opposed slavery. Delegates then were ready to nominate their candidates for president and vice president. On the first ballot, they chose Lincoln to run again. And they chose Democrat Andrew Johnson of Tennessee to run as vice president.
During the campaign, Lincoln was advised to begin peace talks with the South. End the war, he was told. Bring Southern states back into the Union. Settle the question of slavery later. Lincoln, however, believed his policies were right for the nation. He would not surrender them, even if they meant his defeat in the election. Lincoln hated the war, but he would not end it until military victory ended slavery and guaranteed political union.
In August 1864, Lincoln wrote, "For some days past, it seems that this administration probably will not be reelected. Then it will be my duty to cooperate with the president-elect to save the Union. We must do this between Election Day and Inauguration Day, for he will have been elected on such ground that he cannot possibly save the Union afterwards.
The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. Peace Democrats were in firm control. Peace Democrats demanded an immediate end to the Civil War. They did not care if the North and South remained apart permanently. The party's statement contained these words: "After 4 years of failure to restore the Union by war, justice, humanity, liberty, and the public welfare demand that immediate efforts be made to end the fighting. Let us look to a convention of states or other peaceable means to restore the Union."
The Democratic statement did not discuss slavery. It did say, however, that any state wishing to return to the Union could do so without losing any of its constitutional rights. This was believed to include the right to own slaves. Convention delegates approved the statement. Then they nominated General George McClellan as their candidate for president.
3 days after the Democratic Party convention closed, the Union won an important military victory. Union troops captured Atlanta, Georgia. Atlanta was one of the last remaining industrial cities of the South. Its loss seriously hurt the Confederacy. Now the people of the North could understand their side was winning the war. Public opinion began to change. The Peace Democrats lost popular support. President Lincoln and his National Union Party gained popular support. Even some supporters of radical Republican candidate John Fremont turned to Lincoln. Fremont withdrew from the race.
When the people voted in November, their choice was between Abraham Lincoln and George McClellan. A vote for Lincoln meant a vote for continuing the Civil War until it was won, until the Union was saved. A vote for McClellan meant a vote for stopping the war, stopping short of victory. By midnight of Election Day, it was clear that Lincoln had won. He got only about 500,000 more popular votes than McClellan. But when electoral votes were counted, he got 212 to McClellan's 21.
Before Lincoln's second inaugural, he agreed to hold peace talks with representatives of the Confederacy. The talks would be held at a Union fort on the Chesapeake Bay. Lincoln was very firm in one demand. The talks, he said, must discuss peace for our one common country. There could be no talk, he said, of Confederate independence. The Confederate representative said they could not accept those terms. The peace talks ended in failure.
Lincoln returned to Washington. He prepared a message that he wished to send to Congress. It contained a program he felt could end the war within a few weeks. Lincoln proposed $400 million in economic aid to the southern states. The money could be used to pay slave owners for freeing their slaves. Half the money would be paid if the Southern states gave up their struggle by April 1st. The other half would be paid if they approved by July 1st a constitutional amendment ending slavery. As part of the program, Lincoln would pardon all political crimes resulting from the Southern Rebellion. He also would return all property seized by Union forces.
Lincoln's cabinet officers rejected the program. They urged him not to send it to Congress. They said it would be seen as a sign of weakness. Lincoln was surprised by the reaction. He thought his cabinet would gladly end the war, a war that was costing the government $3 million a day and the lives of the nation's young men. But he accepted the cabinet's advice. He did not send his message to Congress.
On March 4th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as president for a second term. This is part of what he said. On this occasion, 4 years ago, all thoughts were directed to a coming civil war. All feared it. All tried to prevent it. Both parties opposed war, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation live. The other would accept war rather than let it die. And the war came. We hope and we pray that this terrible war may pass away quickly. But God may wish it otherwise. He may have it continue until the riches earned from 250 years of slavery are gone. It may continue until every drop of blood made by the slave owner's whip is paid for by another made by the soldier's sword. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
That night, the White House was open to the public. Thousands of people went to see the president. Poet Walt Whitman gave this description. I saw Mr. Lincoln dressed all in black. He was shaking hands, looking very sad, as if he would give anything to be somewhere else.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce. You can find transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.